There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
There we go. Now, unless we're going to, do we need to do any more parenting commiseration before we're done? Because I also have two girls, but Scott, you have
I have two boys, but
they're now
19 and 21. So I'm right. well out of the woods.
Yeah.
on the one hand, it's the best thing in life. I mean, I'm jealous that you guys got young kids, but on the other hand,
right.
wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah. Well, you've instilled some creativity in them, right? Like I saw the short that you guys made
My son is actually Atticus, who's a brilliant composer, is doing the score for Black Phone 2.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And my other son, Dashiell, is also a musician. He just made his first college applications and got into his first choice college. And they're off and running.
Dad wins across the board, man. Congratulations.
Raised a couple of musicians, man. It's great.
Nice. Yeah. Well, that's great, because that's cheap labor now, like for the rest of the career. Well, you got composers.
I had my younger son do a music video that plays on a TV, like 80s style at one point in Black Phone. So they both participated a little
nice.
Bit.
Nice.
I'm glad they didn't go into Hollywood. I thought my youngest was going to be an actor, and he did enough of it to realize, man, this is for the birds, which it is. So mm-hmm.
Nice. All right. Well, let's go ahead and do a show here.
Let's go.
All right. And we'll do the opening here. Mike, I think when we did the last one, did I catch it right that you were like, while I was reading the intro, you were holding up the book cover? That seemed like a good distribution of labor there. So let's replicate that on the, there you go. All right, here we go. One Heat Minute Productions presents Guide for the Film Fanatic, the podcast where we invite a guest to pick one movie from Danny Perry's seminal 1986 film reference book and talk to us about that movie. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host. Our guest today, friends, is just a terrific filmmaker whose credits include The Black Phone, Doctor Strange, Deliver Us from Evil, and, of course, my beloved Sinister. His new film is called The Gorge. It stars Miles Teller, Anya Taylor-Joy, and Sigourney Weaver. Nice cast. And it premieres this Friday on Apple TV+. Please welcome Mr. Scott Derrickson. Hi, Scott.
Hi. There was a little visual hint there about the movie I selected.
Oh man, Mike is sneaking in tips, doing the Dutch there. All right, well, we always start by plugging, Scott. So let's do some proper plugging of The Gorge.
Great,
which is a very clever, really exciting mashup of two sort of subgenres that I've rarely seen put together. It's sort of a military action movie. It's also a kind of a supernatural thriller. In fact, the only other movie that I could think that put those two together shares one of this film's stars, Sigourney Weaver. It was Aliens. What drew you to this particular story? Why did you want to make this movie?
Well, it was a blacklist script. Didn't write the draft of the script. Did a bunch of rewrites on it, but it's Zach's script, and it was, when I read it, it was just the fact that the mashup, it was the things that you were mentioning, but it's also a romance. I mean, I would consider the romantic storyline like the A storyline. You know, I think that's
sure.
I think that sort of is the larger rainbow under the smaller rainbows of like action and a little bit of horror and political thriller. And it just was mixing so many genres in such an unusual way. That was both the scary thing about it and the appeal. And because I thought, I don't know, you know, people are going to want to see something that's like such a genre mashup. of so many things in such an unusual way. And then ultimately I was like, I want to see that. I want to see how that works. And that's always has to be your guiding light as a filmmaker. I think, you know,
what movie would they pay to see?
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's what it is.
That's excellent. Well, I am glad you mentioned that, because one of the things that I was really impressed by is how well you create the chemistry and the attraction between these two characters throughout a first act where they are not sharing the screen. They're not sharing a frame. They're separated by a considerable distance, the distance of the titular gorge. And yet you completely buy as a viewer that they fall for each other, and the movie doesn't work if we don't buy that. Totally. So how did you approach that particular challenge of making the chemistry work when you couldn't have them in a physical proximity to each other?
I mean, it was three things in kind of descending order. The first thing is the script. You know, I just thought that the writer did a great job of, I could feel that on the page. I thought there was something sublime going on in the writing and the text that was on the cards that they hold up for each other, all of that. And then for me, in terms of my participation, the second thing is casting, you know, and casting people who when you're talking about actors of that level, you don't get chemistry reads, you don't get auditions, you know, but
right.
I felt,
oh,
I just,
wow. Okay.
I just had a feeling, you know, I just was like, I can see these two being together. I bought both of them as snipers, you know, snipers, snipers. I did a lot of research and reading about the world of snipers and these kind of high trained, skilled, you know, assassin type characters. And it's a young man's game. You know, the record of the most kills by any military assassin was a 19-year-old in Vietnam, still holds the record, did two tours. He was so good. He just did two tours, killed so many people because he was just so good at the job, and then never killed anyone again. Then left, did his two tours, and that was it. So I guess the last thing is the directing of that part of the movie was surprisingly complicated, you know, because we built these big sets and you can't really put the other actor in front of the actor who's acting. So you've got Miles and Anya in real separate spaces acting alone, you know, without the other actor to interact with. And I have to describe to them, well, I shot that Thursday and this is what they did, you know?
Right.
And both of them somehow had a real instinct and a real commitment to being careful and deliberate about all the nuances of those exchanges. And it just, when we cut it together, it just really worked.
That's nice. It totally plays. As you mentioned, you more often than not, at least co-write your screenplays.
Yeah.
That is not the case on The Gorge. The credited screenwriter here is Zach Dean. I'm just curious about how your approach, your methodology changes, if at all, when you're directing someone else's script as opposed to one of your own.
Well, I've only done it. It's only the second time I've done it. You know, I did it on The Day the Earth Stood Still. That did not turn out so well. For a lot of reasons. The biggest reason being that while we were prepping and working on the script, the writer's strike happened. And I sort of got stuck making a script that nobody thought was finished. And we just shot that, you know? And so I was very gun shy about doing it again. But you know, for me, it's not about whether or not I've written it. That doesn't seem to be, it's in and of itself meaningful, but I don't think that I can do something well if I don't have a real personal connection to the material at that point in my life. If it doesn't speak to me on an emotional level about something that I am feeling deeply, then I sort of, I don't know how I can continue to generate passion for it. And I had, recently, in the last 5 years, fallen in love and gotten remarried. And I had that experience. And it was a relationship that, you know, where we fought hard to be together and it was difficult, you know? And so there was something about that script that really spoke to a major part of my life experience, you know, in the preceding couple of years.
That's really lovely, man. That's that's what, so that's why you were ready to make your romance. That's beautiful.
That's what, Oh, I never could have made a romance before that. Before that. not a chance, man. I just wouldn't have been in me.
Yeah. This is kind of a tricky question. I don't want to put you in an awkward spot, but
you won't.
I want to talk about this to a real filmmaker. This is the first feature you have made directly for a streaming service, if I'm not mistaken. It'll That's debut right. on Apple TV Plus on Friday. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of conversation from those of us who love movies and specifically the theatrical experience about the pros and cons of these streamers and the movies they make. I really like this movie. It is such a gorgeous movie to look at that I did find myself wishing I could go see it in a theater. So I'm just curious where you land on this ongoing conversation as a filmmaker who's like right in the middle of it.
No, it's a really fair question. And, you know, it is a really big movie. And, you know, we're going to have a couple of theatrical screenings in the next couple of weeks. We'll premiere it in a big theater. And that's the only time that I've yet to see it with an audience in a big theater finished, you know? So that's the first time I'm going to have that experience too. But I, you know, when I went into it, it was the fact that it was two things. It was the fact that, you know, I love the script, but they were going to give me the amount of money that I needed to make the movie with. It's an expensive movie, but it's Apple, you know, and people, you have to remember with Apple is that, you know, our big movie budgets are chump change to Apple. You know, I mean, the whole movie business is like the coins that fall out of their pocket at the end of the day, you know? Yeah. And so I knew that there was going to be adequate funding and I was going to get to make this very audacious, really kind of bold movie that, and honestly, from the get-go, at first an assumption that it was going to be a streamer. And then as we started shooting, it certainly became much more of a conversation of, are we going to go theatrical? I don't know what app. There was a lot of conversation about that. And so I shot it in such a way that it would play. I thought it would play either way. It would play very well in the big theater. And it would play. You do have to shoot things differently. The way a home system, you know, how often you use close-ups, how tightly you shoot things, all of that. And I really tried to monitor that to where it would work either way. But when they made this final decision to keep it a streamer, honestly, I'll be really straight with you. I was relieved. And I was relieved as a filmmaker because I didn't have to go through that anxiety of wondering, is the success or failure of this movie going to depend on that opening weekend? You know, something that I don't have any control over. And so there's a great... there's a great relief and a great relaxation that I have for the opening of this movie that I've never had before because I don't have to be anxious about how it does on opening weekend. That's really wonderful. I really like that. I do think that what this movie demonstrates that most streamers, in my opinion, have not, is that the value of streaming movies is the people who are financing big movies, and Apple did this in this case, ought to be taking big swings. Because they don't have to market the movie or sell the movie based on stars or concept or high concept. They don't have to simplify things or be reductive in what they believe is going to sell and be able to recoup a budget of that size. And so it doesn't matter if it's a big movie or a small movie. Either way, I think that you know, streaming is a little bit of the Wild West. You can do anything. And so the exciting thing about it is when people do allow filmmakers to make audacious movies and try things that in the theatrical world where you've got to recoup, you know, 2.5 times your budget before you even break even, where no one's going to want to do that. So I think that there's a plus side to it. I think there's a creative factor involved there, you know, for both filmmakers and for people who are financing these films that's exciting. You know, so, but all that said, I love theaters. I still like, I love seeing movies in a big theater, and nothing beats that experience. So do I think it's one is better than the other? Yeah. I think the theatrical experience is better. You know, I'm not crazy, you know, so.
Well, it's a really good movie and I hope lots of people see it however they see it.
Yeah.
Before we get to the matter at hand, we should also mention, because this is fascinating, you just wrapped principal photography on The Black Phone 2.
Yeah.
this will be, again, correct me if I'm wrong, your first time directing a sequel to one of your own films.
That's right.
Other people have directed sequels to Sinister and Doctor Strange, but this is your first time returning to one of your earlier works. So like, how was that experience?
Incredible. I had an amazing time. It's a much bigger, much more complicated movie. And I think, you know, the making of the film was complex as well, but I don't think I've ever had more fun making a movie. You know, the thing that made me want to go back to do it, I've always been resistant to the idea. And in this case, the initial thought that I had that started me down the road to working on the story, and it was two things. Joe Hill pitched me an idea that I thought, oh, that's interesting. And we used about 75% of that idea.
Sure.
And so that was, but for me, it was the first movie was really a middle school coming of age movie. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I wait and like make a big movie in between, then those kids are going to be in high school. And then I can make a high school coming of age movie, which is exactly what it is, you know, and it, which is a very different kind of movie. And, I think that was the thing that made me, feel very passionate, because I love those kids. I love the characters, and I love the kids who play the characters, and I love Ethan who came back for the movie also, and
nice,
and Damien Bichir is amazing in it. We really had a great time. I think we shot a very good film.
All right. Well, looking forward to that one then. Okay. Well, let's get down to brass tacks. What film did you select to discuss today?
I selected Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon.
Rainy ass movie. There's a lot of rain happening.
Heavy rain.
It was a vision of hell. I'm going to read the subtitles. A bandit, a woman, a samurai, and a woodcutter. Four different voices, four private hells. A tale that winds deeply through the jungles of the mind. While the beast of carnal desire lifts its flashing eye. The notorious bandit Tojomaro is begging you on his hands and knees. Sorry, I shouldn't try to act this stuff. Please say yes. Tell me you'll be my wife. I'm no Toshiro Mifune, I'll tell you that much. But this original trailer is fascinating, because you're really seeing how it was sold in Japan when it came out, just as another, you know, sort of Japanese historical epic. I am in darkness now. I am suffering in the dark. Cursed be those who cast me into this dark hell. There's your cat close-up. There's your snake close-up. We got all of our animal close-ups in the trailer. That's good. That's how you sell a movie. I don't want to hear it. No more horror stories. It is human to lie. It's a lie. It's all a lie. Tajimuro's story and the woman's. Don't. Don't look at me like that. Oh, sorry. That's her. I used a too deep of a voice. It's too cruel. Beat me, she says. Kill me. But don't look at me like that. Please stop.
I don't know what to do with this lady.
Mm-hmm.
She is going... She is giving you every possible version of an emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, like, sometimes I trust her, sometimes I don't, sometimes I like her, sometimes I'm like, she deserved it all. I don't know what to do with this lady. That's a good character, man.
Japan, deep in the woods on a hot summer day, the searing passions of human desire burst into flames. A powerful tale of human conflict. Two men face off in a desperate duel. An entrancing beauty looks on with disdain. Is she goddess or demon? In a crumbling corner of the great capital city, Rashomon Gate listens to the wind and to this tale of the human soul. Rashomon. That's the trailer that they put out in 1950. So Rashomon was the 12th feature film directed by the GOAT Akira Kurosawa, who co-wrote the script with Shinobu Hoshimoto, whose other screenplay collabs with Kurosawa included Ikuru, Seven Samurai, Throne of Blood, and The Hidden Fortress. So they had a good partnership. He initially tried to make the movie in 1948 for Toho, his regular studio, but it was seen as too risky. Its producer, Jingo Minura, resurrected it 2 years later for the rival studio Daiei film. It was shot in July and August of 1950 and premiered in Tokyo later that month. They put them together quick back then, I guess.
1 week.
One week
in post.
1 week of one post, week. Scott. Well, how does that sound? It was Kurosawa's second release of 1950 following Scandal in April of that year. Mike, what does our friend Danny Perry say about Rashomon in Guide for the Film Fanatic?
Danny says... You know, he loves to... that's why
he
we
likes
love
to mix
him.
It up. He's unpredictable. Unpredictable. He likes to mix it up.
Oh, you're not going to tell me that he gave it a bad review.
It's not a bad review, but it's not as good a review as it should be. Let's just say that.
It's okay. A fascinating thing, too, because it comes out in 86. And so, you know, there are certainly some sort of critical consensuses that have been reached by 86, but not sort of, they don't have the gale force of the internet.
Right.
You know, you sort of don't agree with somebody. And you can tell that he's just sort of having these conversations with like him and his two buddies.
Yeah.
Right.
Fascinating thing about. Anyway, okay, here we go. Quote, Akira Kurosawa's classic was the first Japanese film to receive widespread international distribution and success. Derived from two short stories by Ryunosuke Akutagawa, Rashomon and In a Grove film centers on the trial of a wild bandit, Toshiro Mifune, who has been arrested for raping a woman, Machiko Kyo, in the forest in front of her tied-up husband, Masayuki Mori, and then murdering him. Mifune, Kyo, and Mori, his spirit speaking through a medium, and a woodcutter witness, Takashi Shimura, all give their versions of what happened. We see in four separate flashbacks that the stories contradict one another, that they usually but not always benefit the one who speaks. Film doesn't hold up as well as other Kurosawa works because there is no such thing as absolute truth theme isn't particularly novel. But it shouldn't be forgotten that Kurosawa broke the rules of cinema storytelling. It is less important that any four people will tell four different versions of a story than that any filmmaker is capable of taking a story and visualizing it in an infinite number of equally persuasive, audience-manipulative ways. Mifune makes a strong impression, playing a character similar to one he and Kurosawa saw in a Bee Jungle movie, but the other performances are either irritating or forgettable. Playing of Bolero at one point seems inappropriate. Disconcerting opening and conclusion were inserted into script so the picture would be long enough to interest a distributor. How does he know that?
I have a one-word review of that for that review, which is poppycock. Poppycock. That is a bad...
Tasteful. That's a tasteful response.
I really disagree with that, with this fundamental saying that it's not exactly novel for 1950. Unbelievably novel. The phrase the Rashomon effect is like a pop culture phrase, you know, and it's talk about a film that has been often imitated, never surpassed. So.
But one thing that I forget now when we talk about a Rashomon thing, a lot of times the way it's put together, it's like, you know, if there's four versions or however many versions, the last one is like the one that really counts. Mm. They sort of do this mystery novel thing where like the last version really sort of fills in so many blanks and ends up being the one to be believed. And every time I watch this movie again, I'm like, you still don't know the truth at the end. You still don't know. And that is something that I think
more would be wise to imitate.
Didn't sort of come along. Right.
Yeah. 100%.
Go ahead. That's what's amazing about the story. And when you hear the woodcutter story, the four story, you feel at first like, oh, this is the real story. Right. And, and it also is the one that has the most in common with the first story. There's a lot of the facts and a lot of what he tells go along with the bandit's testimony, and then veers from it significantly. But the biggest problem with that review, the biggest misconception in that review, mistake, he's wrong, is that each testimony is told to benefit themselves. That's false. Each person who gives their testimony tries to take blame for the murder, except for the woodcutter. You know, the bandit says, I killed him. And then and then the wife says, I killed him. And then through a medium, the husband's like, I killed myself. You know? So I wouldn't say they're really, really trying to benefit themselves by what they're saying, which is, I think, very significant, because I don't think that the lies that are being told here, or the delusions, lies to oneself or lies to the court or lies in the tale that's being communicated to the neutral character there at the Rashomon gate, the common man. You know, I think that each story has some motivation for why they would say some of the things, but fundamentally, they're damning themselves by most of what they say.
Right. Well, let's go back a little bit. Give me just a sense of your personal history with this film in particular, with Kurosawa in general. When did his work and this movie in particular sort of come into your life and start to feed kind of how you think about cinema?
Great question. Well, first of all, I don't even know if I even told you this, but I teach a college course on Kurosawa.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which I've taught a couple of times.
Nice.
Whenever I get a chance to do it, I've taught it at seminars in sort of condensed form. He's my favorite director, bar none, by far. I think he's the greatest director in the history of cinema. I've seen all 30 of his films multiple times, because when I teach my college course, my students see all 30 films. And my introduction to him was actually the year that Dreams came out, which was
85, 86,
somewhere in there. And I was watching a movie, and I walked into the wrong theater, and Dreams was on, and it was the scene. It was just before I went to film school or anything. And it was the scene with the giant flowers, the two guys sitting with the giant sunflowers. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Oh my God. I was just like, it was so amazing.
How old are you at this point in your life?
Oh, at that time I would have been like 19, 20 maybe.
Yeah, that's the right age to get your mind blown by Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah, I was interested in who that guy was. I went and saw that movie. That was the first movie I saw. Dreams was the first, because I saw it in the theater. I was like, I have to go see whatever the fuck that was. Mm-hmm. And then I got interested in him, and just started in my later college years really going down the rabbit hole, seeing every one of his films. And Rashomon was a very important film to me personally, because it was at that period of time, you know, in my later undergraduate college years, when I was really, like most people, really having a nervous breakdown and beginning to lose all faith and belief in anything I'd ever thought was true. And reading existentialist literature, and you know,
like you're supposed to
and just going down that slide of despair, man. So with Rashomon, I think I was a philosophy student as an undergrad, what was so interesting to me was, here was this film in 1950 that was the ultimate modernist film. I mean, it was really a film that was advocating this idea that truth is unknowable, you know, which is a really distinctively modern idea. I mean, that's something that didn't start entering even the philosophical landscape until, like, you know, the 19th century. And then the existential writers came along, some of whom were writing, you know, the populist existential writers, Camus and Sartre, were writing right at this time and right before this. And I don't have any knowledge of Kurosawa being influenced by them directly, but this idea of this epistemic nightmare of, you know, that truth cannot be known, There is no.
And they're
truth.
All being influenced by two massive world wars, and you know all the stuff
yes.
that like, led the futurists to say like burn all the museums down because look what history has created. Like even if they don't know specifically, like oh yeah, I got the Marinetti letters. Like even if they don't know that stuff, they're all breathing the same air. They're all hearing the same
right.
nuclear
exactly.
bomb warnings. All that shit.
And so there was something about the way that the movie was so it took it on, and I still think to this day, it took on that the idea. Again, he talks about it being a novel idea, not at the time, but also nobody went as far as Kurosawa. Nobody else has made a movie where it's like you have all these multiple points of view, and then they're just unreconcilable, and that's the story. There, everybody who plays with this idea, whether it's you know the usual suspects or Edward Zwick's Courage Under Fire, or whatever, they always ultimately there's a revelation. You're like, this is what really happened, or a soldier
right.
story, you know.
Right.
And I think that the fact that it didn't do that, and yet Kurosawa, the thing from the short story from In the Grove that he added that wasn't in the short story. There were two things, very significant things that he added that were not in the short story. One was the common man, which is how he's usually mm-hmm. referred to, the guy who they're telling the stories to, who
right.
Takashi Shimura is and the priest are telling the story to the common man there at the gate of Rashomon, the guy who builds the fire. And the other thing is the ending, the whole thing with the baby. And I love the fact that only Kurosawa would take on something so bleak and so despairing in its tackling of the question: is truth knowable? Is there any kind of, do we as humans have access to any kind of objective truth or any kind of objective knowledge of history or of our own reality? And the answer seems to be no, but then he immediately moves into, then what's our moral responsibility? You know,
yeah.
what do we do?
Yeah.
What are we supposed to do with it? And that was what made me really love the movie. Because I was like, yeah. he's not going to let go of, and that was very existential, you know, that was very existentialist, this idea of like, well, okay, you still have to have, you still have to make choices about the kind of life you're going to live and the kind of influence you're going to have. And even if they're not rooted in anything divine or anything essential or anything, you know, the whole word existentialism just means, you know, existence precedes essence. Morality is not essential. Knowledge is not essential. Everything that we know and think and do and care about and consider moral, the idea is that's all a construct. Okay.
Wow.
Well, then construct it.
What
construct
then?
It. Yeah. What then? And then he has the great Takashi Shimura, you know, take that baby at the end as a response to this whole thing, which I thought was really, I just think is really beautiful.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
That, you know, the other thing that really jumped out at me on this viewing, and as I was sort of thinking about these big questions, because I knew you'd want to talk about them, that hadn't occurred to me previously, you know, is that in addition to the inscrutability of the varying accounts, we also have to keep in mind that there's another frame of relaying here, that there's another party in this game of telephone. It's like, it's not just that it's, you know, the bandit story and the wives story and the hood, but it's the priest and the woodcutter relaying everyone's story to the common man. So
that,
like, we're getting yet another interpretation.
I don't think that you can grasp that the first time you see the film. I've seen this movie more than any other Kurosawa film. It's
okay.
It's in my top five, but it's not my favorite. But it's the film I've seen the most times. For sure, maybe because it's the shortest, and it also has, it's also the most dynamic in a lot of ways. There's like 400 cuts in this movie, which is like doubles the norm of his films. It's very, it's a very sophisticated piece of filmmaking. But it wasn't until I had seen it quite a few times that what you just said landed on me, for me. And there is one theory that is the only theory that I have heard. It was Donald Ritchie, who was the great Kurosawa scholar.
Yeah.
And Donald Ritchie had proposed in one of his books a scenario that is the only theory I've heard anybody state that does reconcile the stories or make sense out of the different stories.
Okay.
And I'll jump to the headline, the end conclusion. And he doesn't necessarily ascribe to this, but he said, but this is one way it can make sense, which is the woodcutter killed the husband.
Wow.
And the reason why is because the woodcutter is the one who tells the story of, he's the one who tells the story of the bandit. Mm-hmm. And then, and he doesn't tell the story about the wife. The priest tells the story about the wife. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that he tells the beginning and the end story, and he is essentially lying about what happened in both of those situations because he was the one who ultimately killed them.
Wow.
And so I was like, oh God, that actually, and that's why he's so guilt ridden and mm-hmm. not for stealing the dagger, which is what mm-hmm. the common man accuses him of, but he's feeling, and when he says there's a line in it when he says, I don't know why I did what I did. And when you hear that line in the line of the theory, it's like, oh God, that's really horrible. You know, and that's why he's like, okay, I'm going to make up for it by taking this child and giving him a good life. I took a life. I'm going to raise this life instead. So I love it. I love it. At least as a theory.
I appreciate or don't appreciate you adding yet another layer of confusion to this movie that I already can't make sense out of. As I was hearing you say it, I was like, that's amazing. But then as you were finishing it, I was like, shit, that's just another thing I don't understand about it. One more thing about when I watch Rashomon.
But isn't that, it's like why I love Flannery O'Connor so much. You know, I think Flannery O'Connor is probably the best writer of the 20th century. And I know that she's fallen into you know, some less than popular opinions lately, as people have scrutinized some of her letters and some of her racial comments and all of that. And I think for good reason, it's worth talking about. But the genius of her short stories is that they sort of lead you down this road and into a cul-de-sac where you're like, you can't get out of it when you're done reading it. You're like, well, I didn't think we were going there. We're going there? Wait a minute. Right. What the? And then when the story's over, you kind of can't make real sense of everything. But yet your brain has been placed in where she wants it. And then she's got you thinking about things that she wants you to think about long after the story's over. And Rashomon does that. You know, it makes you just, if you take it on, you know, you're going to be chewing that gum for a while.
Yeah. I have to follow up just on a throwaway comment. What is your favorite Kurosawa film?
My favorite Kurosawa film, for very personal reasons, is Akira. That is my personal favorite. I think, you know, I think he has more masterworks than any other director. I think half of his films are masterpieces. I think he's got 15 films that really, really deserve the word masterpiece. The top five for me would be Rashomon, Ikuru, Seven Samurai, High and Low, and Ron. I think those are
pretty unimpeachable group of films.
Yeah. But I think there's ten more that I think are real. And some of them, like The Lower Depths, that people don't really watch and know about. This is a masterpiece. Great film.
Right.
You know? So,
right. Yeah. Anytime we're lucky enough to talk to a filmmaker, I always want to make some space to talk about form, because it's something that you have a more intimate knowledge of than we do. And I especially, the comment that you made about the sheer volume of cuts in this movie, I found really fascinating, because one thing that I really noticed this time around also was that it's that he's only using cuts, that there are not, that when he's going from sort of testimony to memory, when he's going in and out of quote unquote flashbacks, he's always doing hard cuts. He's never doing the sort of, you know, fade or ripples or any of the sort of cliche visual language of that kind of a transition.
He does a couple of dissolves, and he has like a wipe or two in there somewhere. But for the most part, it's an extremely cutty movie, which is not his style typically. You
right.
know? And he was a real master of blocking, and was very good at moving. I mean, High and Low, the way he would move and sometimes very long takes and move people around and reblock. He's the best. He's the absolute best at that. But you know, with this movie, it is really driving and adrenalized, and that it's funny because as complex as the movie is, you'd think that the movie would be long, and instead it's really fast. It's a really short film.
It's over in a flash.
And in film, in terms of filmmaking, it was the first film that got me thinking about specifically about his skill in lensing. You know, the woodcutter's walk in the forest at the beginning is so spectacular. It's like rhapsodic. And and that was a scene that I studied as a young filmmaker, to see the way that he would, unlike most filmmakers, he was not prone to use wide lenses or long lenses. He really traded them up in a skillful way that I think is still like state of the art. There are some filmmakers who do it well. Spielberg can do it very well. But like Martin Scorsese, I think the first Jake or the first Sugar Ray Robinson fight in Raging Bull is like the only long lens scene I think that guy ever shot. Everything he shoots is with wide lenses, you know. And then you got you know, Paul Greengrass and Pete Berg and guys like that who shoot, and Tony Scott who shoot everything on really long lenses. And Kurosawa was so skilled at why he used the lenses that he did in terms of, and usually in usually for their impact on motion, you know, and long lenses for horizontal panning and the motion that was created that way, and wider lenses for motion on the Z axis and depth, and the way he would break that up. But then in this movie, because he's got a triad of characters that everything is built around, you know, the bandit and the wife and the husband, and he's always framing like these three people, but then he's cutting the interactions of them to each other, looking at each other, having responses to each other. And I'll tell you, as a director, I don't care who you are, there's nothing a director hates more than three-way coverage. It's just a fucking, it's just a fucking pain in the ass. It's like it takes so much time and getting all the lines right. And but if you care about it, you've got, and you want to do it right, it's complex, it's difficult, and it's time consuming. And here he was on this very fast budget, and he still did that so masterfully, you know. And so I think the filmmaking in it is extraordinary. And I do think that, you know, when I was in a film school and I was really going down the Kurosawa rabbit hole, I had a friend of mine, Eric Koyanagi was his name, a Japanese film student. And we were talking about him, and I was talking about the weather in all of Kurosawa's films, and how weather's like this character every time. It's the heat in Straight Dog, or the or the wind in Yojimbo that blows in with the arrival of Mifune, you know, and the rain, and of course in the big climactic battle scene in Seven Samurai, and the rain in Rashomon. And Eric told me something that I didn't know, and I've looked it up a few times, but it's actually hard to find good full information of it, even on the internet right now. But he said, yeah, there's like 100 words for rain in Japan. And I said, wow. What? And he said, yeah, in the Japanese language, it's like snow with Eskimos, you know, where they don't see snow. They have like, you know, hundreds of words for all the nuances of snow, because that's their livelihood, that's their life, that's what they live in. But in the Japanese language, there's all these languages for rain. And I was like, oh, no wonder the rain is always so good in Japanese movies. Yeah. All of them too, you know, floating weeds, the rain and you know, the Ozuyas. It's because they see something and hear something very different than what Westerners see and hear, because we have, you know, like five words for rain.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and to that end, talk to me a little bit about the sound design of this movie, because I was really struck by the fact that it feels like each segment, each sort of recollection has its own soundscape, has its own sort of appropriate score or lack thereof, that some of them play in sort of eerie quiet. What do you think is sort of interesting and influential about the way he uses sound in a movie like this?
I mean, I think this is a bold statement, but I think it might be his most interesting film sonically. I think the sound of the rain, the deluge of the rain, and the atmospheric hypnotic quality that has, and the weight that gives to those opening lines, where it's like, there's never been anything worse than this. This is the worst thing I've ever heard. This is impossible, you know. And none of that would land the same way that it would without the soundscape of the rain in that. And then, of course, the score. I think the use of bolero is wizardly, you know, again, part of that modernist era of everything, all the rules being broken up. But then when I think about Rashomon, the first thought that comes to my head, it's still, I watched it, I showed it to my kids, because my son, Dashiell, rather, he had not seen it. He's a big Throne of Blood fan. So I'm slowly like showing him Kurosawa films. And man, when I watched it again, I was like, the sound design of the medium when she starts speaking is so fantastic. Mm-hmm. I still hear it, and I'm like, that's cooler than anything I've heard in any movie this year. It's still so great. I was like, I don't know how he did it. I don't know what the process was, but there's something about the bass and the echoey, like all of our sophisticated Pro Tools, you know, equipment nowadays somehow can't create something with the sonic impact of that medium's voice. It's phenomenal, you know. And I really think that he and then like you said, the rises and falls, the weather being a lot of the wind, the little breeze mm-hmm. of wind that hits the bandit when he's like, and I felt this breeze, and then I looked up and he sees her lift her veil, and that was the beginning of all this, you know, horrible shit happening. You know, it's just, it's, he was the best director. I'll just give you my one sort of like basic theory. Like when I talk to my film students about him, you know, what I always say about Kurosawa is that I don't think that there was another director who aspired to or achieved, and he did both, an attempt to be as high as possible in terms of cinema art. He was making great, he wanted to make great art. He wanted to make art that was a 10, but he wanted to make entertainment that was a 10. And he managed to do both things at the same time over and over and over and over again. And I don't think there's any director in the history of cinema that accomplished that the way that he did. And I have a pet theory as to why, which is that I think that he was such a unique student of the world, and really a student of cinema, loved the whole history of cinema. And I think that he was distinctly Japanese. I mean, all of his movies are either samurai movies or modern Japanese movies, mostly set in Tokyo. But he also loved European cinema. And I think he really grasped and understood what made classic European cinema the high art that it was. But I think he loved even more John Ford. You know, he loved Hollywood Westerns. He loved Hollywood cinema. And somehow, from a distinctively Japanese place removed from both things, he was able to cobble them together. And I think he made, you know, movies that had the entertainment storytelling power of Hollywood, but with the artful filmmaking of European cinema, and did that through a very distinctively Japanese lens. And I just think that no one else did that. No one can touch him as far as I'm concerned. And I think that's the essential thing about him. And then of course, then there's all his Russian influences, you know, he's being right. a big Dostoevsky fan and that being right. his favorite writer, you know? So he was a very well-read, well-educated man when it came to all of the art in the world.
Beautiful, beautifully put. Thank you for breaking that down for us, Scott. All right, friends, let's talk about the release and reception then of Rashomon, which opened in New York on December 26th, 1951.
Can I say one thing before you get into the actual release? I just want to say this because the studio head, before we talk about this, because the studio, of course, they make it to make money. The studio head's name was Nagate. I still remember it because it sounded like negative. It's like, there's the studio head's name. So he walked out of the screening. He walked out of the premiere of Rashomon. Thought it was a bad movie. Just left.
Wow.
Just got up and left. And nobody thought that the movie was going to be great. And when it won the Venice Film Festival, they didn't submit it for the Venice Film Festival. The Venice Film Festival contacted them and was like, "Hey, can we have this movie for our festival?" And then it won. And everybody in Japan was like, "Wait, what? This?" You know, like they didn't understand it at all. And I just had to throw that in just to, you know, and this is the same guy who then butchered Kurosawa's next film, which was The Idiot, his favorite novel by Dostoevsky, his favorite writer. And that he's the guy who pulled, I think, like 90 minutes out of that movie, this lost forever. So I mean, it's probably his worst film to watch because there's an hour
it's
and
half a movie. Yeah.
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 Exactly.
Jesus Christ. All right, so by the time it makes its way to America at the end of 1951, the other films in Gotham cinema that day included Tales of Hoffman, An American in Paris, The River, Caesar and Cleopatra, Quo Vadis, Showboat, My Favorite Spy, The Oxbow Incident, The Lavender Hill Mob, Pandora and the Flying Dutchman, and at the Paramount, you could see Double Dynamite, starring Jane Russell, Groucho Marx, and Frank Sinatra, with an in-person appearance by Tony Bennett. And you know what? I would like them to bring back the era. Well, I was looking at all these ads. Like, I want to bring back the era where you would go to the movies and there would also be like a singer and a big band beforehand, and you got a whole damn entertainment out of it. Mike, what were the news headlines on that day?
December 26, 1951 was obviously the day after Christmas 1951, so the headlines are full of fancy people pretending to be happy and enjoy the holidays. Lots of pictures of famous people holding presents that may or may not have anything in the box. Definitely had some nice wrapping paper. Pictures of their kids and family members that they may or may not have loved, but they definitely had some fancy wrapping on their kids too. Top of the list was President Truman, who reportedly was enjoying a blanket of snow in the winter wonderland of Independence, Missouri. But we all know that's a lie, because if you've ever been to Independence, Missouri, you know nobody's enjoying themselves. The King of England gave a speech on the radio, and he didn't sound as healthy as they would have liked, so that caused the most annoying people on Earth to debate about his health. It was a slow fucking news day, bro. That's really what I'm getting
at.
I think most of the reporters and newspaper people also got Christmas off, and good for them.
Yeah.
Things were not going well in the Korean War, but you wouldn't know that if all you saw were the staged Christmas tree photos on page two of the paper. And finally, in Wallingford, Connecticut, let's get to a real family story.
Okay,
real
I'm ready.
Family holiday story.
Okay,
all
great.
Right?
Let's warm my heart.
Mr. Terrence Joseph Saunders came home from work on Christmas Day. He apparently didn't have a union like the newspaper people, to find that his Christmas dinner had not been prepared.
Okay.
So he started yelling at his wife
for
ruining his Christmas. And then this yelling culminated in him taking the Christmas tree out into the yard and shooting off the ornaments with a .22 rifle. All right.
Okay.
Sounds like a pleasant guy. So at that point, his oldest son, TJ Jr., I don't know if they called him TJ, but I'm going to assume that Terrence Joseph Jr. was probably called TJ, came outside, told his dad to chill the fuck out. Instead, dad pointed the gun at him and said, "Keep your mouth open and you'll be next." So, TJ Jr. went in the house, loaded a shotgun, and when dad followed him upstairs, he took care of dad on the stairwell on Christmas Day. And then he went and got in the family car and he tried to drive to New York because I guess he thought he could just hide out in New York. But then he got pulled over for speeding and he pulled over. Like, he clearly didn't think all of this through. But nonetheless, that was the very last Christmas for Mr. Terrence Joseph Saunders. And my guess is he earned it. So that's headlines.
Not such a slow news day after all.
That wasn't
Saunders house.
We got an episode of Forensic Files in there.
Actually, what I need is I need to know that entire story from the perspective of each participant involved in it.
To bring
things full circle. All right,
Jason, what did critics say about Rashomon?
Well, Bosley Crowther of the New York Times knew what was up. He called it, quote, an artistic achievement of such distinct and exotic character that it is difficult to estimate it alongside conventional story films. He continued, as we say, the dramatic incident is singular, devoid of conventional plot, and the action may appear repetitious because of the concentration of the yarn. And yet there emerges from this picture, from this scrap of a fable from the past, a curiously agitating tension and a haunting sense of the wild impulses that move men. Much of the power of the picture, and it unquestionably has hypnotic power, derives from the brilliance with which the camera of director Akira Kurosawa has been used. The photography is excellent, and the flow of images is expressive beyond words. Likewise, the use of music and of incidental sounds is superb, and the acting of all the performers is aptly provocative.
Well, then.
Over at the New York Herald Tribune, Otis L. Guernsey Jr. wrote, "Rashomon is a study in human nature stripped down to raw animalism and photographed with remarkable perception and great visual power. It is based on a Japanese novel giving four versions of a murder described by four observers after the fact, and its episodic arrangement forces it to concentrate on keenness of detail rather than construction. It never collects itself into a single emotional purpose, but it is like a series of glimpses into the void with shafts of sunlight from the upper world half illuminating the terrors which lie in wait below the surface of normal behavior." It's a nice line.
It never collects itself into a single emotional purpose.
I mean, I think I disagree with that, but the other part of that I like.
I kind of think that describes all of my favorite art of the medium of all time, actually. I think maybe I'm going to get that tattooed onto my forehead and be like, "Do I like your shit? Well, let's see." Rule one,
And Variety opined, direction is excellent, shot completely outdoors, the camera work is flawless, brilliance of conception, technique, acting, and its theme of passion make this a good art house bet in the U.S. Exploitation values are there, and cricks should go for it. That's how Variety likes cricks. How did it do in terms of box office and awards, Mike?
Rashomon was initially respectfully, if not rhapsodically, received by audiences in Japan. It was Dai's fourth highest grossing film of the year and one of the top 10 of the year overall in Japan. But it became Kurosawa's first international hit of note, particularly after it was quietly and very apparently intentionally programmed in the 1951 Venice Film Festival and won both the grand prize, the Golden Lion, and the Italian Critics Award. That recognition got it picked up for U.S. distribution by RKO, which released both subtitled and dubbed versions. It also did well across Europe, particularly in France and Spain. It ended up grossing nearly $1 million worldwide, which was nothing to sneeze at in the 1950s. Have you ever seen dubbed Rashomon?
I hope not.
They had English accents. It would be completely fucking ridiculous. I would hate it so much. I'm glad I've never seen the dubbed version.
There you go.
In addition to those Venice prizes, it won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Hell yeah. It was also nominated for the Oscar for Best Art Direction, Black and White. It was also nominated for Best Film at the BAFTAs and Best Director at the DGAs. The National Board of Review gave it both Best Foreign Film and Best Director. And it was the New York Film Critics Circle's runner-up for Best Foreign Film. Talk about a guy getting his fucking flowers. He had to rent a truck. That's great.
But there's the book. There's the book review. You know.
Well, you know.
can't get them all.
Can't win them all. Now it's time for a segment we call Double It Up, where we each select one movie that we think would make an ideal double feature with today's focal film. Scott Derrickson, you're our guest, which means you go first.
My double feature with this is Kurosawa's Ikiru, which came out 2 years later, I think 1953. And I picked that for two reasons. One, because Toshirô Mifune is the greatest movie star in the history of cinema. But the guy who doesn't get enough credit in Kurosawa's career is Takashi Shimura, you know, who is astonishing in so many great Kurosawa films. And he's the woodcutter in Rashomon. And he plays a man dying of cancer who has an awakening, a kind of awakening out of a state of mummified despair, as they really describe him. And the reason I'm picking that to be, the reason I think it's a good pairing with Rashomon is not just because it's another Kurosawa film or another Takashi Shimura movie, but because thematically, the thing that I was speaking about, where my love for Rashomon comes from, this sort of existentialist tale about this epistemic nightmare. How do we know what we know? Well, we can't really know anything. All truth is relative, all of that. If the most existential film he ever made was Ikiru, which is something that takes sort of classic components of the idea of people being in states of despair, being unconscious in the world, and then having an awakening and facing the abyss. And then what do you do with that? And then the idea of you make a willful choice into some kind of endeavor. Usually it's through art and you know, wine, women, and song, which he tries in this movie and doesn't really work for him. And then it becomes an ethical journey, which is so beautiful. I think it's the most meaningful film I've ever seen. And I really think that what it has to say about what Rashomon has to say about truth, I think Ikiru is sort of the equivalent of what of that same kind of film in a lot of ways, but it's about meaning, and in an era where truth had disappeared and truth was became unknowable, and meaning the universe became indifferent and everything was meaningless, and yet here he was tackling these two giant subjects in just a span of 3 years, with Dostoevsky's The Idiot in between. Unbelievable.
Right.
I just think that the pairing of those two films really capture a lot of what he was obsessed with for the remainder of his career.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good combination. I went with something a little more on the nose, just because I did want to sort of acknowledge the profound influence of this movie and this sort of format on storytelling. And I went with something, a picture that you actually mentioned earlier, which is Ed Zwick's Courage Under Fire.
I think it's the best Rashomon knockoff. I think it's a really, really good film, and it's the movie that does the most justice to the Rashomon style.
Yeah. And, you know, just because of when it came out and how old I am, I saw Courage Under Fire before I saw Rashomon. So this was sort of my introduction to this idea of, a high tension incident told from multiple perspectives by someone who's, you know, trying to sort of filter out the truth. I think you're right. I agree that it does all of that in a really fascinating way that sort of takes each of those approaches and does something unique with them. But the other reason, aside from the conversation we're having, is with the exception of, like, I don't know, Malcolm X, maybe my favorite Denzel performance, and not one that you ever hear people talk about as one of his best, but he's the character that he's playing is an alcoholic who is sort of hitting bottom while he's trying to sort of lift himself up through this assignment. And the depths of alcoholic despair that he conveys in that performance are kind of astonishing.
It's so powerful. I still remember the scene with Lou Diamond Phillips when he's in the car and he's busting him. He said, "I can smell it coming out of your pores." And he, like, takes his booze and he pours it out the window defiantly as he's talking to him, you know. Mm-hmm. So good. It's a great character. Boy, it makes me want to go watch that movie right now.
I know, same.
Yeah.
All right, and Mike, what's your pick?
God, I'm going so much more. My logic and reasoning is so much more sort of base. I'm just not going to sound as cool
Is it another rape movie? Is it going to be that base?
No, man. I just, like, I think if you're going to watch another one, watch Stray Dog, just because, like, you know, it's Kurosawa. It's 2 years before instead of 2 years after instead of Akira, right? But, like, it just, like, I had sort of thought of, like, I sort of thought, like, all Italian movies all sort of look like The Conformist, and, you know, Japanese movies were all sort of this thing. And then the first time I saw Stray Dog, I was like, wait, like, he's obviously seen all of the fucking movies. He's obviously not just sort of like watching no plays and then going and learning how to set up a camera, right? Like, this guy has seen fucking everything.
Yeah.
And the sort of the elements of Stray Dog that are recognizable from other parts of cinema, I think, like, especially if you haven't already eaten all of this stuff, you know, with a spoon, like, that, to me, there's a lot to be sort of gained from watching Stray Dog, especially for somebody who hasn't A, seen all of his movies, B, seen everything else that came out at the time, or seen all of the noirs, or, like,
right.
Like, if, unless you're really deep into this, there's a lot of things, you know, how, like, when you move to a new town, and then there's that first day when you're, like, on your bike or in a car or something, you're like, holy shit, wait, I recognize that. And you're coming from another thing you recognize, and that's the first part of the new town that you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you two spots, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
To me, like, there's 1,000 of those intersections in Stray Dog.
for you to be able to pick up from other
cinema and say, like, oh, I see how he was a part of the conversation that was happening then, in a way that you don't get from Rashomon, because it's so fucking Japanese, for one thing, just sort of, you know, all of the visual everything, but also it's based on these old short stories, but also because it's, as we keep saying, it is unique, it is original, it is sort of such an expression of his shit. That, like, you're really, there's not a lot to learn about cinema from the movie. There's a lot to learn about him and about Mifune, right? A lot about filmmaking and how it's been digested since then. But if you want to learn about movies at the time, fucking Stray Dog is top five for me.
It's also great to pair a modern Mifune movie and to see that kind of naturalistic acting. that he was capable of doing, because you know, all the samurai stuff that he did was always inspired by the kabuki theater tradition, and the like, you know, Throne of Blood, this very operatic kind of performance. And that's what he was doing, a bit of that in Rashomon. But you know, you look at Drunken Angel and Stray Dog, especially Drunken Angel. I mean, it was like method acting before Brando. You know, it was, the naturalism of it was so extraordinary, and Kurosawa became just mesmerized by that. The most disciplined methodological, you know, director, he would when you talk about making Drunken Angel, his first film with Mifune, he said Mifune would just like wander off the set in the middle of a take, and he had to start lighting things differently because he just didn't know what the guy was going to do, you know. Yeah.
Nice.
And that's one of the things also that I think is a nice pairing, is to see if you put those two films together, you get a really good sense of the range of that actor and what he was capable of doing.
When this is something that we've been sort of doing on this show that we've never really done before, and it started with Godfather 2, of thinking about, because Perry was not, his review of Godfather 2 is not as sparkling as we sort of assume everybody's, you know, feelings are now. Yeah. And one of the things he says is basically that Pacino's fucking boring, and the only way he's watchable is because everybody around him is so good. So then we start sort of talking about counterfactuals and all this kind of stuff, right? And there is this idea of like, what other actor could play Stray Dog and Rashomon at that time as credibly, and that's like what you're saying, like, because the thing he's doing in the samurai movies is sort of intentionally big and ridiculous and you know, extra performative, but he makes it work. Nobody ever complains like, oh, I don't know, he's overdoing it a bit. No, the shit is perfect, and especially for the scenario he's in. And then to go, like, could Cary Grant play? Right, could, like, I mean, you see like Orson Welles trying to do that, but when he's doing the Shakespeare stuff, he's intentionally ridiculous as Falstaff in a way that reads as ridiculous, in a way that Mifune, it just doesn't read the same. And like, I can't think of a great, there's got to be a Russian dude whose name, who I just don't know because I'm an idiot, but like, a really solid counterfactual of somebody. It's, you know, like, talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman in, you know, 1998. Like, nobody else is sort of going back and forth between the roles that he's able to play, right? Anyway, Stray Dog, man. But you can't fucking go wrong, dude. Just pick any one of his movies. It doesn't
matter.
We can sit here and write a whole book comparing one to any of the others and be super happy about it.
Yes, indeed. Scott, the new film is The Gorge. It's on Apple TV Plus on Friday, and it is a good, good time. Where can people follow you on social media?
I left Twitter for the same reasons a lot of people did, and I'm on Blue Sky, and I'm on Instagram.
Nice. I am Jason Dash Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. Mike, where can people find you?
Avoiding the internet.
Okay.
Good for you.
Perry Rocks on YouTube.
There you go. Yeah, if you like the show and you think other people might like it too, as always, we ask you to leave us a rating and or a review on your podcatcher of choice. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get our weekly show notes and bulletins and all sorts of stuff, you can get that at buttondown.email/filmfanatic. If you'd like to make a donation to support us in the show, you can do that at ko-fi.com/funcitysounds. And if you're one of those weirdos who likes to watch videos of people recording a podcast, find us on YouTube at our channel, Danny Perry Rocks.
Our humblest thanks to our guiding light, Mr. Danny Perry, author of Guide for the Film Fanatic, and a shout out to executive producer Blake Howard, whose adoption of an abandoned child restored our faith in mankind.
Thank you again, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening. Join us in 2 weeks when the King Danny Perry himself joins us to discuss I Walked with a Zombie. See you then.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.